This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It may very well go down in our history books as the trial of the century here in Honolulu. Today begins the extensive jury selection for the Kealoha trial. Honolulu Civil Beat's Nick Gruby is on the line with today's reality check. Morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us, you're down there at the Neil Blaisdell Center where more than 400 prospective jurors are being quizzed. What's it like?
Well, right now it is empty. Today the jurors, 413 prospective jurors actually, were in the Blaisdell Center's Pakake room, and they were filling out a questionnaire to see if they will be one of the 12 jurors selected to listen in on this trial and decide the fate of Lewis and Catherine Kealoha, as well as their three co-defendants, Derek Hahn, Gordon Chir Ishii, and Bobby Nguyen.
So what do you think we can expect? How soon will we see opening statements?
So that kind of depends on the jury selection process. So today we had 413 people fill out this questionnaire. And from there a bunch of copies are going to be made. All the lawyers in the case are going to comb through them and sort of narrow down that list of 413 people to about 40 or 45. From there, they're going to go through the traditional jury selection process in which they go to the courthouse and then they start questioning the prospective jurors. They'll strike a few from there, and then they'll argue over some, and then eventually we will get down to that magic number of 12. Of course, there will be a handful of alternates as well in case something does come up for one of those jurors. But they're looking to hopefully start that process this week, possibly as soon as Friday, and then the trial itself. They're aiming for that for opening statements to begin on May 22nd or possibly May 23rd.
So did the jurors just go down there, fill out the paperwork, and then leave, or are they still there?
Yeah, it was pretty quick. Like I said at the top of the segment, that I'm standing in an empty room. It's a bunch of empty chairs. And, they did turn the Blaisdell into a courtroom today. But it was actually kind of interesting. Judge Michael Seabright, who's presiding over the case, came out, and he was wearing his robes, but he was standing on a stage behind a dais rather than sitting on a courtroom bench addressing the jurors. In some ways, it felt more like a high school commencement where you had a bunch of people sitting there looking up at this judge, talking to them about the importance of being a juror, especially in a case that's as high profile as this one.
So this case is going to boil down to the theft of that mailbox, right? I mean, is this a far-fetched tale, or is it really fact? Was there a frame-up and a cover-up?
Right. I mean, so we have to remember that this case all started in June 2013 when the Kealohas said that their uncle, Catherine Kealoha's uncle, Gerard Puana, had stolen their mailbox. From there, the case sort of spun out into what is much larger than a mailbox theft, and it involves questions of whether the Kealohas had framed that uncle, Gerard Puana, for the theft of their mailbox. In addition, federal prosecutors say they found a lot of other evidence of criminal activity, whether it's police officers falsifying reports and lying to investigators, to allegations of financial crimes and financial fraud that the Kealohas are alleged to have been perpetrating. Of course, those financial charges are not included in this trial. This trial just focuses on the mailbox and whether the Kealohas and their co-defendants had framed Gerard Puana for the theft of that mailbox.
And I know there was some discussion about getting the testimony from Florence Puana because she was having some medical issues, and they said if she was fine and ready to go for trial that she would be allowed to proceed, but they wanted to have that backup of the tape.
Right. Florence Puana is 99 years old. She is Gerard Puana's mother, and one of the motivations behind this alleged frame-up, according to the prosecutors, is that Florence Puana and Gerard Puana were asking questions about a reverse mortgage deal that Catherine Kealoha had executed on their behalf. they said that she appeared to have taken a lot of the money from that deal and used it on herself. Now, Florence Puana, again, is 99 years old, and there were some concerns about her health and whether she would actually be available for the trial when it starts. And so they did, they allowed her to do a video deposition just in case. Now, that doesn't mean she's not going to be a witness in this case. She could still come and testify live before the jury. But if not, if she's unavailable, at least they have that video of her answering questions to fall back on.
Right. But we haven't heard anything about her condition recently, have we?
At this point, I haven't heard any updates. But I have heard from others who are familiar with this case that the hope is she will still be able to testify.
Okay. Well, you're going to be down there at federal court for a long time.
Yes.
This is the first of three.
From Washington, D.C. for it.
Yeah, and Catherine Kealoha is facing three trials.
She is. So she's on trial in this case for the alleged mailbox theft. The conspiracy surrounding the alleged mailbox theft. She faces a second trial along with her husband, Louis Kealoha, for the alleged financial crimes and bank fraud that that prosecutors say they were involved with. And she faces a third trial for drug-related charges in which prosecutors say she and her younger brother, Rudolph Puana, were running a prescription drug trafficking ring and that she was using her position as a city prosecutor to sort of hide that from authorities.
It is really an amazing sequence of events here, isn't it? All right. Well, thank you so much, Nick, and we'll be checking in with you regularly during the course of this trial.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. That was reporter Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. This morning, we invited retired Star Bulletin crime reporter Rod O'Hara into our studios to talk about the trial and about police culture. He worked for nearly 40 years at the Star Bulletin and also the Honolulu Advertiser as a sports reporter. He was on the city desk, and he was also the crime reporter.
I think, in my opinion, it's not something that surprises me, the depth of it. It's just that I think it's the first time we've seen something like this exposed as much as it has been, the explosion of it. Because culture in Hawaii, whether it be police culture or it's all the same. It's one fabric, and it's tied together since the Democratic Revolution of 1955, where Hawaii, it didn't take very long for Hawaii to become a one-party political state. And by becoming so, a lot of good happened, but also with generations of being in power for so long, the Democratic Party had seen its own fabric change.
But they've had scandals.
Well, I think when you have everything intertwined like it is, where, for example, to get elected to office, you have to have donations, and the unions provide much of the donations. Those who get elected to office then decide who gets appointed to what. Who gets contracts? It's hand feeding hand. Then you have people being appointed for many years. The police commission didn't act like it is now. It was for many years, for example, Ron Takeda, the executive secretary of the Carpenters Union, was the chair of the police commission. And, you know, he's appointed by the mayor. And how many mayors appointed him? I'm not saying it was bad, but you're only going to do what the hand that appointed you wants done. Now, the police chief at once upon a time sat in on the mayor's executive meetings. He was a member of the cabinet. So was the fire chief. And so when you have this kind of interaction, we've never seen, until this Ke Aloha case, we've never seen where the entire fabric got exposed.
So you were talking really about the power structure.
Well, it's all connected.
Well, what do you say to people who are cynical and say, yeah, it's who you know in this town?
Well, how does it become who you know? I mean, we all grew up in this town. For example, in the Ke Aloha case, who doesn't know 20 people, any of those people that are under investigation? Who doesn't know them? I mean, as friends, our good friend Jim Dooley wrote a book titled Sunny Skies, Shady Characters. And I think we all in our culture have been friends with everybody who, if you can find a perfect scenario of nobody ever did anything wrong, I think we're a forgiving thing. Where the problem occurs is anytime you have one power, one as soon as you make an exception to the rule, you stretch the boundaries. And where do you stop? For example, if you ask me from my 20 years or so of looking at the police department, I have no doubts in my mind that 95% of all police officers are hardworking and honest. But they are human beings. They make mistakes. The bad part about all this is when you cover it up. I think we all realize that you can make a mistake. And but I think when you look at this particular case, the sad part is it's the cover-ups. And now you're getting broader and broader. So there are no boundaries as to what, you know. The sad part about all this is just the leadership. But that's not an indictment on current leadership. I have great respect for Chief Ballard and John McCarthy, one of her deputies, who, when I first started out, they were major and captain in Kailua. And I got to work with both of them. And I honestly, from the very beginning, told my friends that I think she has a chance to become the first female chief. And I think that one. But see, she's got tough task ahead of her because you're changing attitudes.
You're changing the culture, or she's trying to change the culture. Yeah. And I didn't grow up here, but I remember when I moved here almost 40 years ago, I was told, oh, if you don't want to get stopped by the cops, put a Chopo sticker on your car or a Kamehameha school or a St. Louis sticker on your bumper, you know, on your bumper. I mean, I mean, but
I'm
that's,
a crusader now.
Yeah, but that was a kind of, you know, what I was told.
Well, again, we go back to that favorite line of ours. It's who you know. There was a guy, we all knew him, I'm trying to think of it, Okuda, who fixed all the tickets.
Fat Boy Okuda.
Yeah, once upon a time. But, you know, at the same time, we had parlay sheets going all over Honolulu, downtown Honolulu, parlay sheets, the little gambling sheets. So, and it was for high school games, and I covered high school sports.
Do you think that they're betting on this in Chinatown?
Well, I think what has happened, you know, in Dooley's book, he mentioned how they took odds on Alema Leota when he ran for governor. But, you know, it's all, when you come down to it, we're all connected. And that's what makes it hard. Because as much as we might say we're surprised by what happens here, we also know that there are many good aspects in every person. So these people that are on being investigated right now, they've all done good things. So I remember Luis Kealoha when he was a captain in CID, and he had come up, and I had no idea he would someday be up for chief, but I saw him as a very quiet kind of guy trying to learn the ropes. And so I didn't think much about it until his name surfaced chief, because I thought it was going to be very, very difficult given the culture and what happened to Mike Nakamura, that another captain would rise above the majors and the deputies to become chief again. It's awfully hard, because each of these deputies and majors, they have their own, I compare it a lot of times to feudal Japan, because these are lords and you have the shogun, and not all the lords, you can't be the shogun without the lords. And so if you take a guy who's a captain and promote him over everybody, it's hard.
What good do you hope comes out of this trial?
I hope that we can correct the old culture, the attitude of it's who you know. Because if we can correct it's who you know, then it levels the playing field. The second thing is, I think you have to go about your business making no exceptions.
That was retired journalist Rod O'Hara talking about the case against Honolulu's power couple, Police Chief Luis Kealoha and his wife Catherine, who was a top deputy city prosecutor. Both are under indictment and facing serious allegations of abuse of power.
Hi, my name is Peter Ho. I'm chairman and CEO of Bank of Hawaii, and we've been a proud supporter and sponsor of HPR for many, many years. Hawaii is, you know, arguably one of the most remote locations in the world, and so Hawaii Public Radio is just a wonderful tool in my mind for businesses and business people and just community leaders and people in the community to stay connected, not just to the islands, but also to the world.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard, we're seeking an invasive species. Introduced to Hawaii as a pet, this bird was illegally released into the wild on Oahu in the mid-1950s. Since their numbers have exploded on Oahu and have been encountered on Hawaii Island, each year this bird is responsible for an average of $300,000 in damages to orchids on Oahu alone and an estimated loss of $30,000 in Hawaii crops. They've been blacklisted by many countries around the world as one of the worst invasive species because of their crop destruction and role in spreading invasive plant seeds. Interestingly enough, it is beloved in its native India. After crows, they are the most popular birds in the Indian Peninsula, so popular, in fact, that their name is a slang term used by local residents to express affection. Now, this species can reach 8 inches in length, and it has a glossy black head and neck with white and crimson tipped tails. For today's quiz, can you name the bird, the name of that bird that some regard as little terrorist? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank Wealth Management, with advisors committed to providing personalized service for clients' planning, investment, and insurance needs. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
Hawaii School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto has been on the job for about 2 years. She's now focused on the next 10 years, preparing to roll out a promise plan to improve teaching and learning. She's asking for public feedback.
So I am very excited. We have a 2030 Hawaii Promise Plan, and it's basically our next 10-year strategic plan. And it focuses on the work that we're going to be doing from 2020 to 2030 with a hyper-focus on 5 promises to students. I can go through those promises, but the idea is to use student-centered promise statements rather than using aspirational goal statements to drive a strategic plan.
Okay, and now is this approach something that you came across somewhere else?
Well, as I'm looking out at our strategic plan and the work that we've been doing and the areas of progress and the areas that need improvement, we often talk about being very student-centered and, you know, what do students need to be successful. And so as I've continued to work with community, I thought it would really resonate with community if we set those goals in terms of promises that are specific to our promise to students. If we deliver on those promises to students, then we'll organize and design our operations around what it takes to deliver on those promises to students.
So how are we reaching out to our school community?
So we just released a set of documents online that allow, it's basically a toolkit that allows anyone in the community to get onto that toolkit, learn about the promise statements, and then interact and provide feedback on those promise statements. And then around the end of the summer, we'll be collecting and looking at all of that feedback and then creating our first draft of our 2030 promise plan. That draft will then be taken out to community again for response and reaction.
And have the principals gone to the parent-teacher groups to get some of that initial input?
The school principals and the complex area superintendents will be meeting this summer, and they will be holding a variety of retreats to go over the promise plan, the promise plan statements, to give us feedback, and then the principals will take the first draft of the plan and go out to their communities during the fall.
I see. Okay. And so what are these promises?
So we've designed 5 student-targeted statements around 5 areas of promise. It starts first with a promise around Hawaii, delivering our educational opportunities based on really honoring place and honoring what the student brings to place. So Hawaii is the first promise. The second promise is equity, which focuses on providing every student equitable access to quality programming and quality educational learning. The third promise is focused on school design, having a diverse portfolio of highly engaging school design models throughout our state. The fourth promise is around innovation and ensuring that we remain on the cutting edge, what we offer in the classroom, as connected to career pathways and ensuring that students are prepared to be leaders here in Hawaii and globally. And our fifth promise is around empowerment. In order to deliver these kind of promises, we need students, teachers, and principals to be empowered at the school level to design and to stay at the cutting edge in terms of innovation. And so empowerment is absolutely critical to sustaining this kind of a design.
And then how do we interface these promises with our budget, with our funding, and our facilities?
Yeah, so great question. What we're transitioning to is starting to look at, through our committee on waste, to look at the per pupil allocation at the school level and what's driving the per pupil allocations that we make on an annual basis to schools to be able to support the work that they're doing to deliver on the promises, and also to look at outside of the per pupil allocation, how are we structuring our budget at the state level so that the state work is hyper-focused on how do we support schools in their work. What's the work that we have to do around accountability, since we're both a state education agency and a local education agency for federal purposes? And so we have a high level of accountability, but also making sure that we're not doing programming at the state level, but that we're transitioning that empowerment to the school level, and that we're doing supports instead, high level support and capacity building.
You know, we recognize that you do have a difficult job as superintendent of a statewide system, you know, the only one in the country. And, you know, we have had our challenges. We've got the teacher shortage. We've got the issue hanging overhead with Title IX and gender equity and facilities.
So we do have a lot of challenges, but I will say that I'm excited that over the past 2 years, we have pivoted to being very planful in creating a much more sophisticated and modernized operational system in order to get that work done. So we have the delivery now of our Future Schools Now approach, and that has created a system in which we can track and publicly share the capital improvement projects and the repair maintenance projects we have. So now we use that plan. We went to the legislature to ask for capital improvement funds and repair maintenance funds, and the legislature turned around and gave us money attached back to the priorities in that system. So we are leading with being much more planful and having these modernized systems. I think that makes a huge difference in saying, how do we become a sophisticated, state-of-the-art organization at the same time that we're meeting these demands for high-quality schools, that there's a business side to running a district that's a combined state education agency and a local education agency. And I think those are things that we've been talking about, modernizing our financial management system. That's a huge lift, but we are already doing an RFP for that so that we can have a modern system, again, to align our strategies with how we do budgeting. We're also modernize our human resource work to much more of a talent management approach to focus on what are the multiple pathways to bring in talented teachers and to have a benefits package and a kind of community where we retain them and they want to stay in Hawaii and they find lots of success here with the public school system.
I know you folks just rolled out that program to help teachers with housing.
Yes. So we didn't roll it out. That's the businesses and the foundations locally got together, and what we are doing is really talking about the landed program as one of multiple approaches that we need in terms of public-private partnership to ensure that teachers feel that they can raise a family here, they can stay here. A lot of our local teachers are just finding themselves outpriced and not able to really leverage their salary. So we have both a salary issue, a competitive salary issue that we have to address, and an access to housing for families to be able to choose to stay here in Hawaii. And so we've got to address that. The landed program provided kind of this convening of business partners and foundations to help support something that we've said we need help with.
Right, right. It's not a panacea, but it's something that could help teachers.
Absolutely. And I'm hoping that this actually, because it came from business and industry and foundations working together with this partner out of California, that will generate new ways of thinking about how do we provide an opportunity for teachers to be able to feel that they can stabilize here, that they can become part of, that they can stay as part of the community, that they have lots of great options here, and that this is a matter of having to leave Hawaii because they don't have multiple options and pathways here.
You know, you mentioned the budget and the funding. The session has just ended. Any disappointments or anything you're particularly happy about?
Well, I would say that there are lots of great things that came out in terms of, you know, our operational budget is mostly whole. There are a few things that were not funded, but most things were funded, and we did get some new funding for things like the mandated nursing services that we provide to our special ed students, and we did receive some funding for workers' comp, which is also mandated by law, and we haven't been funded for that in the past. So we had some added areas. We also got CIP dollars that really are going to support this modernization of our schools and keeping up with these projects. So we have great facilities for learning. The disappointing side, you know, and I don't know, as disappointing as much as we have to keep having the conversation, is housing. You know, how do we address that? There were several bills that came up, and none of them passed on, and I think we need to come back to that. We also are pushing really hard for a statewide conversation around K funding. We have 26 classes in the entire state that are publicly funded, and that really doesn't address many of our students who are amongst our high poverty, high need students, or in isolated communities that have absolutely no pre-K options. And so pushing on that agenda, I think it's important to keep having that conversation as a statewide priority.
And the preschool component, the governor was very hopeful at the beginning of the session about what could come out for those younger children.
I was thrilled to have him lead with that in his State of the State and talk about this as an equity issue. We need to provide equitable access. We have some great pre-K's throughout the state. Many of them are funded through private entity, and so those are fantastic, and if we can grow those as well, that's great. At the same time, we have lots of families who need access to pre-K and don't have the means, and so we can't continue to say that because you don't have the financial means, you don't get the early readiness. We did get funding for 10 additional classes. We were hoping for a minimum of 22. There was a transition of 18 classrooms that are in our charter schools that where the federal fund for those classes ended. And so the state did pick up and provide the funding for those 18 classes. So we are happy that they continue that. Charter schools are part of our public school offerings. So we have those 18 classes plus 10 classes for our Department of Ed. So we have some progress this year. That's great. And, you know, our goal is to keep building on that.
Right. It's a start.
Yes, it's a start.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. And we hope that you will join us for an entire show and a call-in later on this summer.
That sounds great. That'll be fun.
That was Hawaii's Superintendent of Public Schools, Christina Kishimoto. She'll be speaking about the DOE's 10-year strategic plan tomorrow before the He'e Coalition, which stands for the Hui in Excellence in Education. The group was launched almost a decade ago to position public schools as a priority. We'll have links to the Promise Plan on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Zippy's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, and Hawaii Island. Proud to support farmers in Hawaii, serving locally sourced produce and beef in daily breakfast, lunch, and dinner offerings. Zippy's.com.
We have been covering a wide range of topics on the show, and here's some of your responses, starting with Maggie on Kauai, who called in after the Gold Star ID show.
I moved to Kauai in September, right before my California driver's license expired. And the state took my license and then would not issue me a new license. The rub seems to be that because I lived in California since 1971, California had a law that if you wanted to change your name, you could do it through usage, which is what I did 35 years ago. So there's no specific documentation. When I tried to explain that to the DMV, they will not accept that. And now I'm running into the same thing with the passport. So essentially, I moved to Kauai, and now I'm trapped here. I cannot fly anywhere. And that just doesn't seem right. I don't think that that's the point of it. I'm a 72-year-old woman. I'm far from being a terrorist. So I think there needs to be some adaptations made to this law to accommodate the reality of life and stop looking at everyone as a problem.
And after last week's legislative 2019 wrap-up show, we got this from Deborah in Mountain View.
After listening to your entire program, it's really depressing to see how little is actually done in the political system. And my second comment is about the whole water situation and the leases. I was personally involved in doing research and data collection regarding a lot of the water and how it's used on the island of Maui. And I tell you, it's an old boys network, and I feel very strongly that they need an independent review because there is a lot of inappropriate use of the water system over there, and nobody is going to look at it because it's really a political hot button, and the people, the players involved are very entrenched. So that's my comment. Thank you.
We also heard from Mary following our show about preserving your treasures.
Hi, my name is Mary Grandy. I'm from Maui. And they were talking about mold with photography. And I found out a couple of years ago to put all my equipment, camera and everything, lenses, in a toolbox with a container of damp grit in there. And I haven't had any problem with it. So I just thought it was a suggestion. All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
And thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Twitter or Facebook, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also things that we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we are so lucky to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars in the western sky after sunset. Jupiter and Saturn will be visible in the eastern sky and will remain with us throughout the evening. The moon is going to be passing through its full moon phase this week, so that means stargazing for those faint objects is going to be rather tricky.
You've got a little thing about not necessarily alien life or something, but you do have something about a connection to things that we have here on Earth having a cosmic relationship.
Indeed, yeah. Gold, platinum, and silver, those precious metals that we Earthlings treasure, have a very cosmic origin. These valuable commodities are thought to form through a process called stellar nucleosynthesis. This is a process by which heat and pressure in the interior of stars leads to the creation of heavy elements, including some familiar ones such as carbon, silicon, and iron. A recent study by astronomers at Columbia University has suggested that some of our precious metals here on the Earth may have in fact been formed in a catastrophic cosmic collision.
That sounds like it could be pretty intense. What kind of collision exactly?
It is intense. The collision in question was between two neutron stars, the super dense remnants of massive stars that have ended their life in a supernova. Astronomers have been studying the aftermath of a collision which is thought to have occurred billions of years ago.
And how do they figure something like that out when the event has passed? It's such a distant time period.
Well, they studied meteorites here on the Earth. Now, this may sound a little weird, but these meteorites contain radioactive fingerprints that can tell us a lot about where they came from. They also created a sophisticated model of our Milky Way galaxy and concluded that these meteorites were formed from material that came from these two neutron stars that collided over 1,000 light years away.
And I don't think this is going to be what you're talking about Friday, but you're doing a little thing at the Emilo Astronomy Center talking about what?
I will be there, of course, yes, talking about big data and the next generation of large-scale astronomical surveys.
Then that'll be 7 o'clock Friday. And this today was little data, huh?
It is indeed.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fascinating Stargazer. And thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Associate architects for the NOAA Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Earlier in the program, we described an invasive avian species and asked you to tell us the name. Brought to Hawaii from the Indian Peninsula as pets, the red-vented bulbul is known as one of the world's worst invasive species. In the mid-1950s, it was illegally released into the wild on Oahu, where their numbers are growing exponentially. Bulbuls are responsible for an estimated loss of $30,000 in crops in Hawaii and an average of $300,000 in damages to orchids on Oahu annually. Bulbuls primarily feed on fruits, vegetables, flower buds, and insects, but what makes them so bad is their natural love of invasive plants. They are one of the lead distributors of invasive plant seeds like meconium, ivy gourd, and false kava. And although blacklisted by many places it inhabits, bulbuls are beloved in the Indian Peninsula, and their name is even used as a term of affection, similar to our use of honey or sweetie. And congratulations to Jody from Kaneohe. You got the answer right. She says she normally chases the bulbuls away from her mangoes. This was a very popular quiz. One listener actually rescued a baby bulbul fallen out of a nest. Other people called to say they hate the thing. Well, that's our quiz for today. If you have something to share, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Coming Saturday, May 25th to HPR's Atherton Studio. The Pacific Harp Project brings classical harp to improvisational jazz and vice versa. Expect new takes on well-loved harp pieces, as well as the group's own compositions from this Nahoku award-winning group. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
It's believed that there are only 19 of the alala, the Hawaiian crow, left in Big Island forests, and maybe another 125 in the Forest Conservation District. That's why scientists are excited to see a pair of the endangered birds nesting. They believe we could see the first chicks hatched in the wild in at least two decades. This morning, we talked with Jackie Gaudioso-Levita of the Department of Land and Natural Resources Office in Hilo. She tells us that the big day of new hatchlings could be any day now.
The Alala Project is a partnership with San Diego Zoo Global Fish and Wildlife Service and the State of Hawaii Division of Forestry and Wildlife. The team that is out there is checking on the nest on a schedule of every other day, and that is so that they do not distract the parents from the nest. So while we're very curious about what's going on with the nest, it is not checked on daily to give the birds space that they need so that they're just not distracted from the incubation process.
Have we seen the eggs?
So at this point, the eggs have not actually been seen. It is very hard to see up into the nest, especially without disturbing the birds. So it's about 40 feet up in an ohia tree. And because the female has been sitting tight, it is indicative that she is in hard incubation and has been for weeks. So we are confident that there are eggs in that nest, but we have not actually seen them.
So what's the incubation period?
It's about 21 days, but there can be some flexibility there. So it can be a little bit longer, 22 or 23 days. And there are some differences between what has been seen in the wild versus in captivity. But on average, it's about 21 days. We should be knowing very soon if the eggs have hatched, probably in the next couple days, actually. But we do not have any reports from the field at this time that we are seeing chicks in there yet.
But that's pretty exciting. I mean, if this is the first time in how long?
Yeah, so it's a huge milestone. It's a what we call a watershed moment. This is a very, very exciting day in Hawaiian bird conservation. We actually have three pairs that have formed from the 2017 cohort of Alala that were released, two of which are, one has a bird sitting on a nest, and the other two pairs have actually been seen conducting nest building behavior. So it is a very, very exciting time for this reintroduction program. The last time I was talking to folks that studied Alala in the 1990s, and the last known pair of Alala in South Kona was the Kealia pair, and they were last seen in 2002. But actually talking more with them, the last known viable eggs of that pair was actually in 1996. But they were nest building after that point up until the early 2000s. So yeah, we're talking about at least a 20-year period that it's been since we've had Alala nesting in the wild.
So tell us about this pair of birds then you folks are monitoring that may be pretty far along.
It's two birds that were released in 2017 in Puumakaala Natural Area Reserve. The female's name is Manaia Kalani, and the male's name is Mana Olana. Mana Olana, very interestingly, is actually one of the males that survived the 2016 release. So there were only two males that survived that release. So he's actually been in the wild a bit longer than this female. And so these birds actually paired up not that long ago, just about a little over a month ago, and they just became very busy with placing sticks in the crotches of ohia trees. They built multiple nest platforms before they decided on a single platform. And then the team was very excited to see at one point that the female started to sit, and she just started sitting tight. And so now we're approaching our third week now that she has been sitting.
Do we have cameras up there to be able to monitor?
So the team takes live observations, and they'll observe the nest for up to 45 minutes at a time. And they do take live video when they are conducting those observations. There currently are no nest cams or cameras that are set up and left. But this is something that the Alala Working Group has been talking about. We're trying to figure out the best way to monitor the birds remotely, but also get the information that we need without disturbing the pair.
We don't have a lot of these Alala out in the wild. They're really just doing this by instincts, right?
There are no conspecifics or other Alala at this release area other than the birds that have been released over the course of 2017 and 2018. What is interesting about this female that is incubating, she is one of the parent brood birds. So in captivity or in the conservation breeding centers, the chicks can be either hand-reared with puppets so that they're not heavily imprinted, or we have, San Diego Zoo Global has transitioned to a method of parent rearing the birds. So this female was actually parent reared, meaning that she was raised in a nest in captivity by and fed by her parents. Early on, she did have that experience. However, you are correct in saying that they do not have any adult mentors out in the wild to follow breeding cues or breeding behaviors. Essentially, these birds are going off of instinct, and it's very exciting to see that they have done so well up until this point with the construction of the nest and being able to, she's really been pulling long hours, long days sitting.
So tell us about the alala for folks who aren't familiar with it.
Alala, also known as the Hawaiian crow, it is endemic to the island of Hawaii. There have also been some fossil records recovered on the island of Maui, but historically it was only documented on Hawaii Island. It is omnivorous, but most of the foods that it eats are fruits, native fruits from our a variety of fruiting plants in both mesic forests as well as some of the wetter forests. It is a very important seed disperser of these, of the seeds found in those fruits. So it really is like a forest builder. It's a keystone species in that wherever the alala was, it would perpetuate the fruiting plants and perpetuate the forest. And obviously with healthier forests, we have greater natural resources. This bird is, it really supports the watershed through the forest building that it is able to provide. Even though it is primarily frugivorous, it will also eat insects or the eggs and chicks of other forest birds as well. These birds, you know, were once very common across the island, but now we're reduced to, you know, just the birds in the conservation breeding centers and then the birds that we have out there in the wild.
And that was wildlife biologist Jackie Gaudioso-Levita talking about what could be the first alala chicks born in a Big Island forest in about 20 years. Well, we're out of time, but up tomorrow we talk about the problem of teen vaping, what state lawmakers did or didn't do, and what's being considered on the federal level. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line, leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them on our conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.